This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. One of the great pleasures I have in doing this show is to occasionally do something a little to the side of politics, to talk to a fiction writer who, in drawing up a world, makes us see life more closely. And so today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Michelle Hoover, the author of a gripping, haunting novel called The Quickening. Michelle Hoover, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
This is a book in some ways about farming, and I read that you grew up in Iowa to a family of farmers or a grandchild of farmers or something. Tell me about your background a little.
I actually grew up in Ames, Iowa, but during family reunions, we were always toted off to some farm or other, and sometimes we'd be driving across Nebraska and have to go, you know, they had the kids watch the trucks being filled up with grain, and that was kind of the exciting thing for the kids. And so I got I played around farms a lot when I was young, and the smell of a farm, for other people, might seem a little off, but for me, that's basically my childhood. So that's my background with farming.
And Ames is a center of writing in Iowa.
Yeah, they have a really great program there. They've got Ben Percy on their staff and Deborah Marquardt, and they're both amazing writers. Ben's got a new book coming out in the fall that people should look for.
And did you go to school there?
I didn't, actually. A lot of this book and actually the next book I'm working on has to do with why people leave a place. So I was very eager to get out of Ames, and there was nothing wrong with Ames. My father had died when I was relatively young, and we had some other family things, so I think I just wanted to kind of get out. And so I went to St. Olaf College in Minnesota, and they had a great study abroad programs, and I went as many places as possible and still do. And so now I'm in Boston, and I really like it.
How long have you been in Boston then?
I've been in Boston about 7 years, but I lived in Western Mass before that.
Oh, where in Western Mass?
One town, Belchertown, is a great name of a town, and also Ames Amherst and Williamsburg. So those are all right around UMass Amherst, and I got my MFA degree there.
At Amherst?
Yeah, at UMass Amherst.
Did you know the poet Martina Spada there?
Yes, I did. He's very impressive personality.
Yeah, he's got that big baritone voice, too.
I know, he's incredible. He kind of scares me.
He's done great political poetry, though, and has been instrumental in the progressive publishing political poetry.
Oh, absolutely. And there's actually very few writers these days that do make political commentary. I think they worry or get them in trouble or something. What he's doing is pretty amazing.
Yeah, his voice is extraordinary. We have two poems of his coming up in the next 6 months or so.
Oh, great.
And he and Adrian Rich and Marilyn Hacker helped us launch our political poetry back in 1995, and it's been one of the funnest things we've done at the Progressive.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And we had a little collection of them in our book, Democracy in Print, which was the best of the Progressive over the last 100 years. We're 101 years old now, and still have our teeth, I'd like to say. Your father died early. What happened there?
Oh, he had a brain aneurysm, very sudden, when I was young.
How old were you?
I was 14. And so I think that sense of loss and absence is something that I also remember about the Midwest, and it's something I associate to the landscape as well. And so you can probably see that in the book. But the book is primarily inspired by a few pages of a journal that my great-grandmother left behind. It's only about 15 pages. And basically my great-aunt sat her down and forced her to do it. She was in her 70s then. She was in the last year of her life. And she had just lost her husband of almost 50 years. And otherwise she would never have sat down to record her life. She would have thought it was ridiculous. But I think she wanted in some way to remember her husband. And basically in the journal, she'll say at various times in the journal, "I don't know why God has left me here. What am I supposed to do?" And so the journal also carries a sense of loss. And she was really similar to Enedina, just looking back on her life and trying to keep hold of anything that she could. So to me, I relate the landscape in that way, simply because I think landscape is very magical to use in fiction, but it should also carry a character's psychology.
And Adina is one of the two main characters. She is a journal writer here late in her life. And in some ways, I mean, writing a novel or writing anything is kind of like journal writing, in that you want to leave a record.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a really interesting process for me, because it basically brought me back to the Midwest in an important way, because I still carry a lot of what I consider is a very Midwestern temperament that people in the East Coast don't quite get. I don't get easily upset by things, and kind of even keel, and sometimes people think, and same with Enedina, when they've read my character, they think Enedina just is either passive or that she doesn't have strong emotions for things, and that's actually wrong. She's really quite stoic, and she doesn't react to things as readily, especially Mary, because she simply doesn't want to waste the energy. You know, why waste energy to get in an argument? I'm just going to do my own thing.
But so. It's not like she doesn't have an opinion about Mary.
No,
even early on, even at the earliest meeting. This is a book that there are two narrators, Mary and Enedina, and they're quite different people.
Yeah, very different. So Enedina loves the farm. She's a very large woman. She grew up working with her brothers in the barn, and she just kind of wants to be left alone with her husband Frank on the farm, and just make a life together. And Mary is the opposite. She grew up in town, and she's only on their farm because she fell in love with Jack. She wanted something better in her life. She wanted something passionate. So she followed Jack, who's a very passionate and also violent man. And when Enedina and Mary first meet, Mary's the one to reach out first. But Enedina just doesn't know what to make of this woman, and doesn't know why Mary has come to their farm. And Enedina is very suspicious of women overall. And
Mary's snobby, too, from
and
the
Mary's
start.
Snobby. I mean, they both have... I'm really interested in characters, you know, imperfect characters that make mistakes. And I find Enedina particularly admirable, actually, as a character. Mary has a few more problems, but I'm interested in exploring that, because it's just, you know, the basic human faults that people have, and to ignore those in fiction is to ignore the human story.
I'm speaking with Michelle Hoover. She's the author of this haunting, intriguing novel, The Quickening. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Do you mind just reading a short passage to give people a flavor?
Sure. So this is a scene from the third chapter, and it's in Enedina's voice. And Enedina is speaking to, or writing to, her grandson, who she's never met. And she's hoping somehow that he'll come back home, and if he comes back home after she's already gone, that he'll read what she leaves for him, and therefore will understand what their family is about and what happened to them. So she's never actually met the grandson. The only thing she knows of him were his movements in her daughter's belly before the daughter left the family when she was 8 months pregnant. So that's why the book is called The Quickening, because that's what those movements are. Enedina will say, "my boy," at different times. It wasn't until a year after the war that I knew Mary had troubles of her own. It was late in September. The cold weather had come. The season was only beginning, but in the winter months, the world beyond our door would be lost to us. I know, I've seen it. Loneliness can make you do terrible things. It was a time of dark mornings and fresh meat. Frank worked at the butchering without lifting his head, his arms high in front of him. The path of the knife in his hand was clean, unstopping. The fat he cut away fell in a mess at our feet. We were to butcher 8 hogs that day and sell the meat of 4 of them, worth more after butchering than hogs brought in on foot. Frank swung about, his arms greasy to his elbows. The front of his shirt hung with hair and waste. I spoke of sausages, of real meat for supper, how I would prepare them that night in a skillet with a molasses gravy, a side of potato or beans if we were lucky enough. The gravy boiled up thick in front of us as he talked, the sausage skins puckering in the pan above the heat. We had started work in the morning before we could quite see, the walls of our barn and wash house colored while the sun rose. Mary stayed in our house while Jack shared the butchering with us as their family would share the meat. "I have something for you," she'd offered when first they came that morning. She looked nervous and faded, a bruise high on her cheek, and she pressed a sack of flour against her chest. My boy, I can't say I knew how to feel about her then. So sharp was the loss of my first child and her part in it, no matter how innocent. It had been 4 long years since, but I felt a pinch whenever we met. With a sweep of her hair, she kept that bruise of hers hidden. Still, as I led her in, she fingered her cheek until she saw me looking. Now, with the butchering in my hands, I smelled the bread she would bake rising from the table, fat with yeast. I knew the warmth it promised. I kept an eye on our windows as she worked. Mary peered out at times, but never joined us, my fingers full of filth. I'd raised a fire first and started a large barrel of water for scalding. It would be some time before the water was right, before it was hot enough to clean the hogs, but never so hot to cook the meat. Nothing gets them so clean. This is how you do it. You dip your finger in 3 times, you count out slow, 1, 2, and on 3, if the water is ready, it will burn before you take your finger out again. Frank shot the hogs in the dark, and the noise of the gun broke against us. It seemed too early in the season to begin this work. The ground was muddy from summer and the cold unsettled. But I'd started the water and we were hungry. Jack pulled the hogs up with a block and tackle and stuck them so they bled from the throat. Below him, Frank squatted with his face turned, holding the buckets that would catch the blood. He kept his eyes on the water as it warmed. "They bleed better in a warm fall," Jack began. That knife was sure and powerful in his hands. We answered him by dropping our heads. The sun was rising and would soon grow bright. "It would be better with suns, I think." Jack looked at me with this. The ground at my feet felt warm from the fire, but damp with wet. My arms ached as he spoke. I remembered the stone marker from our firstborn. It stood beside our house, kept as best I could from the weeds. It was well out of sight. "To help us, I mean," he went on. He always went on. "They're just boys," Mary thinks, "left them to sleep, and there she is, keeping herself and the house away from all this mess," or so she calls it. "Shame to have this work and no one see the way it's done." "Sons would be more," I started to answer, but left it at that. "Sons would be more to feed," I thought. "You have to start with boys when they're young," Jack started again, "before they get other curiosities. You have to set them right, raise them to know the work." Jack grew quiet, his arms settled at his waist. I thought of Mary at work in her house and always cleaning. She kept her boys in line, tried to wrench the farmer out of them. The first time she stood in our fields, I believe she'd left some bad luck at our place. Now, through the open windows, I could hear her singing high and strained as she baked in our kitchen. "She's the only friend for you and Miles," Frank had said. "I bet you're more alike than you think." But her husband sure was different. Jack stared now at the belly of the hog before him, working his jaw while the animal bled out. "There isn't much pleasure in it this way," Jack said. Frank talked about supper where he crouched, about the steam in the kitchen, our table and his chair. It was a fine sound to hear Frank go on, a fine way that water turned to steam beneath my hands. We tossed the hogs in one at a time, and the water jumped, wetting the ground around the barrel. They floated, turned on their backs, and we fetched them out again. Our hands grew red and wrinkled. Cooling our fingertips in our mouths, we could taste the hog and the muck it had lived in. Frank and I scraped the hides, the hair salting the ground a fine white color, and he swept the back of his hand under his nose. It didn't make Frank sick, this work, only restless and singing to himself. He tried to remember the words of a song and where the words were to rise and fall. It was strange to see a man so stained with grease sing this way. Strange how it lifted me from the work at my feet. Jack cut along the length of the belly, letting the innards spill from the wound. We shared in scooping the rest out with our hands. Beginning at the head, we ran our arms deep into the body, the stench rising from under our fingers as we loosened the stomach, the intestines, the weak fat around the liver. It all dropped to fill the barrels at our feet. We had raised this meat, seen it birthed, give birth, seen it eat our food and wine when it was hungry, had watched it walk, fatten, warm itself in filth. We had raised it to be used. We took it to the feeding trough and forced it to eat, forced the mother to feed her young as they lined up against her belly. They sucked at her while she slept. We spoke always of eating when we butchered, listing the foods that came to us with the seasons. We whispered our favorites to one another, speaking all in a rush. Fried potatoes, sausages, hot noodles, cornbread and eggs, green beans cooked in onion laid beneath a slab of bacon, cream corn and peas my mother made served high in a plate, warmed in a pot all day so you couldn't see what it was, run together in a stew and a juice, sauces and all of it dripping. It tasted like the only food you should ever want to have. My mother, too. It's a wonder. It's a wonder what some women know.
That's Michelle Hoover reading from her novel, The Quickening. And on the next page or two pages later, there's another sense of the violence of Jack that you were referring to. Mary and Jack are a couple, and Adina and Frank are the other couple in this play of a novel. And Jack's violence, I mean, he's given her a shiner, it appears, mm-hmm. and then he is filthy with the pig slaughter and clutches her and gets her all filthy and dirty and hugs her too hard and on the next page. And there's that ominous violence from Jack, and he's abusive to the kids, too. And yet, toward the end, you give him some dignity.
Yeah.
Why'd you decide to do that?
Well, I don't believe that you should ever make a character 100% bad or good. And Jack is a man full of rage and passion, and he doesn't really know what to do with it. And I think for, especially that day and age for Midwestern men, to express verbally in any way any sort of extreme anger or sadness was just simply forbidden. So I think he's frustrated by that. He loves Mary a lot, but he can't keep hold of her. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of his abuse comes out in that. And of course, I don't support what he does, but I understand how he does it. And he's a good farmer, and he loves his family.
And that rage was in him before he met Mary, it seems. I mean, just like was just kind of a volcano in him.
Yeah.
The way I was reading, and yet toward the end, he's honest and honorable in his dealings in some way, which was
yes,
and almost caring in one scene at the very end, which was surprising and interesting to me. In the passage you read, Michelle Hoover, there's a discussion of the first stillborn child of Mary. She has another one, and then she has twins, and then there's another tragedy. There's a lot of tragedy.
Adina's, yeah. I think the Minneapolis Star Tribune called this something like a tragedy hurtling towards disaster wrapped up in another tragedy or something.
There's tragedy in her. And why so much?
This was a desperate time. You know, and to sweeten it up would have been very false to what these people's lives were. Women lost children after children after children. It simply was the way of life. If you read any record of farm life, you'll see how many pregnancies each woman went through and how many pregnancies they lost, and how many children died to farm accidents or just hunger or disease or anything like that. And it was just the way life was. And to me, I don't know how many tragedies are really written these days. You know, we're kind of in an Oprah Winfrey age where things are wrapped up in a bow and there's, you know, the characters at the end suddenly realize something and their life has changed and everyone goes prancing off into the sunset. And that's not always true. It certainly wasn't true for my great-grandmother. She had a good life, but at the end of her life, she was really at a loss. And I think it's important to represent lives that don't fit into this cookie-cutter niceness that we set up for ourselves. You know, we completely ignore, say, what's happening with the war. We cover up how many people are being killed. We don't even know where we're getting our meat from. So we keep everything under a nice cloak.
It is crazy, isn't it, Michelle Hoover, about the war? I mean, unless you have a loved one in the war, it's as though, or in the two wars, it's as if the two wars aren't going on. That is really bizarre.
It's very bizarre. Well, they were just so isolated. Now, I had uncles in, most of my uncles were in the Second World War. And so that was a major impact for them. The First World War, though, and the same that happened with my great-grandparents, the only thing my great-grandmother recorded was that they woke up in bed one morning and heard the horns going off in the town of Moulton, Iowa, 6 miles away. And Frank said, "I bet that's the war. The war's over." And I actually repeat that line in the book. Mm-hmm. It's just so far away from them. They just can't even understand it. And for my family always insisted that they were from Iowa. no matter how many questions I asked about where what our ancestry was, they would say, "We're Iowan. We're from Iowa," and that was it. So,
and that's reflected here in The Quickening as well. There's another subplot in here, kind of a Scarlet Letter subplot. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and why you put that in?
So the letter from the church.
Yeah, or just the affair with the preacher.
Well, I needed, you know, Mary is so wrapped up in anything that she just wants to be important, and she wants to live a life better than she's always given. And so when she meets Reverend Borden, he's a very lonely man, and his goal is to make something of his father's church. And this is a completely different man than Mary has ever met before, and she gets kind of wrapped up in this religious fervor over him. And he's very clean, he's very simple, he's really the opposite of Jack. And I think this is actually pretty natural. When women aren't happy, they go for the opposite. But once they have a very short affair, and the child Kyle comes out of it, and then in the Reverend Borden, you know, he tries to be a good man. He's not very social. He just doesn't know what to do, and so he tries to ignore that it even happened. But I needed something later on that made sense of what the church does to Enedina and Frank. That actually happened to my great-grandparents. They were thrown out of their church because they were doing too well during the Great Depression. They had gas lamps in their house, and they had given too much money to the church. And so the church thought that they were in with the devil, and they were thrown out of the church. Mm. Now, as a novelist, I wanted to use that because that, for me, something, you know, an entire institution betraying you was fascinating for me. And Enedina does slowly get more involved in the church, even though she's a little skeptical of it at first. Frank is actually very quite religious. So I needed a more personal account to have someone individual driving what happens to them that they're thrown out of the church. And so Mary, I needed to get Mary involved in the church early and make her involvement with the church very complex so that she can use Borden to help her.
And he seems like such a weak man, Borden.
He's very weak. He doesn't really, you know, his father was the minister, and he just kind of went along with his father. He had built a church with his father early on and fallen and hurt his leg terribly, and his mother told his father that the father couldn't finish the church. So Borden actually feels very guilty about that and so really focuses only on the church. He has no social skills. He's just not good with people. He's desperately shy. And he can be controlled by, you know, Mary is a very, very strong-willed woman. And she does have something that she can use against him that will destroy his church. And so she chooses to use it in order to save her own family is what she's doing.
She blackmails him, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
There's Henry Wallace makes cameo appearance in the book.
Yeah.
And explain how that happens and why you brought him in.
Well, this was also part of family rumor, this idea of, you know, the hog program coming in and farmers having to kill their own hogs. I remember my family talking about it and what a waste it seemed to them. And how it went against everything they were and were supposed to be as farmers. Mm-hmm. So I used it in that way and was able to, the actual law had them sent away to a processing plant, the hogs, and they were supposed to be given to the poor. But a lot of the meat wound up rotting in warehouses. The processing plants couldn't handle them, especially the young pigs. So lots of the farmers had to handle the meat themselves, which is not what Henry Wallace envisioned. And he was actually very bothered by what happened. But overall, the hog reduction program worked, and it raised hog prices. So it's just interesting what sometimes people have to do as a community or as a group, come together and make great sacrifices for the good of the whole.
Do you want to read another passage?
Sure. So this is also a little bit about the Secretary Wallace part. And this is, again, in Enedina's voice. It was before the twins were born, before I even knew that I was expecting. While John... I'm sorry, I'll start that again. Sometimes it happens. It was before the twins were born, before I even knew I was expecting, that Jack raised his barn. From our yard, I heard him drive the nails and split the wood. It would take a year and more of careful work, as Mary wouldn't let their boys help him much. Holding the twins in my arms, I watched Jack build it after they were born. Over the fields, the frame of that barn stood in the distance, and one at a time, the walls went up and stayed. Jack finished the roof of that barn, painted the sides a dark red. Those twins of mine grew. They dropped from my hold on them and learned to walk, learned to speak their minds and carry out their chores better than any mother could expect. But what Jack did, nothing seemed so great in front of it, so terrible, as the red on that barn from so far away. The years after he finished it were the worst years we'd seen. The price of farm products went to nothing. A bushel of wheat cost $1 to harvest, but sold for less than half. Corn was 10 cents, hogs $3 a hundredweight. Barely a third of what we got more than 10 years back. We burned grain for heat in the winters. It was cheaper than coal. When the banks closed, they raised the interest on our mortgages, and most of the farmers couldn't pay. Just imagine it. A man works a piece of land all his life. Then he loses it. It is stolen away from him. So desperate did some of them become, they decided to take things in their own hands. Up north, the farmers blocked highways, wouldn't let a neighbor from the next town pass for trading. They dumped his cream in the ditches, his butter and eggs. They wanted to force the market, keep the produce from moving. On the railroad, they burned a truss bridge to stop the freight. I couldn't imagine taking up such violence. It seemed as much against the government as against our own kind. But I knew the way they felt, cornered into saving themselves like that. They didn't find such accidents easy. I knew that, too. All of us, we lived good, safe lives. We watched over our own. We didn't ask for much except to be left to ourselves. And we weren't the only ones.
That's Michelle Hoover reading from this fascinating novel we've been talking about today, The Quickening. Now, you say that in your next novel, you're going to continue this theme of why people leave.
Yeah, well, I worry that I've been talking about this too much, but because it's always dangerous to predict your next novel. But a couple summers ago, I found out that two of my great aunts on my father's side disappeared from the family farm as young women and were never heard from again. And I apparently look just like one of them. So to me, why they left together. Why they left is really fascinating to me. And this was my grandmother's generation. I have a picture of the entire family, all the brothers and sisters and the father. And every single face in that picture is a character. I mean, they just come right out. So that's what I'm exploring now. And we'll see what comes of it. I'm really hopeful for it.
Well, I want to recommend again this book, The Quickening, by Michelle Hoover. If you're listening, or if you're in a book group, this is a great book to pick up and discuss. If you're interested in farming, if you're interested in the period in the Midwest from 1900 to 1940,
yeah.
It's a fascinating close-up snapshot and also a real character study of some characters that are kind of hard to forget. So, Michelle Hoover, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.